So no time to dilly-dally, Mr. Bond. Here's the Bond series in 4 minutes. The Bond series is still the longest-running and most profitable film series in movie history. Based on a spy pulp fiction by British Navy commander Ian Fleming of the 1950s and 60s, they became a pop culture phenomenon when legendary producers Albert R. Broccoli and Harry Saltzman produced them for the screen, starting with Dr. No in 1962. Scotsman Sean Connery became rock star famous through his 6 official outings as the debonair British super spy 007. Most importantly, in fan-favorite Goldfinger, the blueprint for much of the later series. He left the series, bored by Bond, so that Australian model George Lazenby got a single gig in another fan-favorite, on Her Majesty's Secret Service, which saw Bond quit his job and get married. The film and Lazenby faced criticism, and Connery was offered over $1 million to come back one last time in Diamonds Are Forever. It was Englishman Roger Moore who steered Bond's character into a more humorous, at times rather ridiculous direction, throwing voodoo, kung fu, and sci-fi at Bond. But entries like The Spy Who Loved Me and Moonraker were still wildly successful in the 70s, and despite his age, he made Bond his own until the mid-1980s, even beating Sean Connery's unofficial last outing in Never Say Never Again. Welshman Timothy Dalton briefly stepped in as Bond in the late 80s, giving Shakespearean depth and Fleming vibes to the character, but audiences weren't ready for a dark Bond. At least, not yet. An attempt to make Irishman Pierce Brosnan the next Bond had failed in the 1980s, due to his ongoing contract for TV's Remington Steele. But he finally inherited the tux in the mid-90s, with GoldenEye and a string of highly successful blockbuster Bonds. Increasingly outlandish, Brosnan's tenure as Bond was suddenly too large for life, and the producers jumped at the opportunity to reboot Bond with the purchase of the rights for Casino Royale, the first Bond novel and the only one to have evaded Broccoli and Saltzman in the early 60s. It had been made into a terrible fiasco of a movie in 1966, starring everyone from Woody Allen to Ursula Andress to Peter Sellers to David Niven. Now, in 2006, Englishman Daniel Craig became James Bond. First bullied and criticized for being miscast, and his dark, brooding and brutish 007 hit a nerve with fans and critics alike. Casino Royale and Skyfall especially were enormously popular and profitable. And had it not been for Corona, his swan song as Bond, No Time to Die, would have hit screens this year. But alas, 2020 was no time for Bond. It would have been the 25th official entry into a film series that has spanned almost 60 years in cinemas and has stayed a family business up until the present day, with the Broccoli family producing soon in the third generation. Their ability to safeguard the Bond formula, while at the same time reacting to trends in filmmaking, current events and popular culture, has been key to the ongoing success of the series. No Bond without staple characters like M, Q, Moneypenny or Felix Leiter, gadgets, exotic locations, alluring women and villainous masterminds and their henchpeople. While there were certainly hits and misses, both at the box office and according to fans and critics, the makers of Bond have kept him both popular, fresh and familiar, a safe bet for numerous generations of filmgoers, and a reassuring ritual in its routine announcement that James Bond will return.
Hello and welcome to a damn fine cup of culture. Today we are going into that most classic of franchises, James Bond. So the new James Bond is going to be delayed indefinitely because of the horrible COVID. We are in the second lockdown now. We don't know when it will be released. We don't know how it will be released. So in this huge Bond-shaped gap, we decided to do a podcast discussing all things Bond, also fair warning, spoiling all things Bond. We assume that our listeners have seen them all by now, possibly more than once. So Bond is not just a movie. It's always this huge collective event type thing. We gossip about who will be the next Bond. Is the previous Bond better than the one before him? Is it going to be like a smash and action movie? Who's going to be in it? Who's going to play M? Who's going to be the next Bond girl? it's a massive collective event rather more than it is just a cinema thing, a movie that you go and see and enjoy or not. So part of the question we've asked ourselves in trying to get to the bottom of Bond is whether this has become so ritualized that we don't even really care about the movie as much as we do about the phenomenon, or whether it still has something to it that's worth looking at, watching and discussing. I also want to take this opportunity to honor, of course, Sean Connery, who passed away, one of the big iconic Bonds of our age. So, with us today are Alan.
Hello.
And as a special treat, we also brought you a kind of Bond expert. Sam is just incredibly knowledgeable about all things Bond, and he will talk us through it as Bond skeptics. So, just to get started, how are you towards Bond, Alan? Do you feel like he's like this amazing thing, or are you a Bond skeptic?
I think I would probably call myself a born-again Bond skeptic, in the sense that as a child and growing up in England especially, where he is just absolutely part of the culture and you can't get away from it. You couldn't get away from not just the cinema releases, but a showing on telly would be a huge event. And you would not want to be in the school playground the next day after a Bond film had been shown without having the capacity to talk about how much nudity you might have seen, a comical death you might have caught, a little bit of gore. You know, that was all part of growing up. And you got to a stage where you didn't even question whether Bond was any good. Bond was default good because everyone talked about it. And I think there's an element of growing up where you suddenly start seeing a little bit of the flaws in the franchise. I always equate it with another franchise we have here, the sort of carry-on comedy films, which are a series of comedy films starring the same British comedy actors over and over again that ran for decades. And again, they're shown on TV so much, they're part of the default background culture, that it takes a while before you sort of think, actually, are they any good? And you start to look and think, is this actually... Yeah, actually, I cannot enjoy this. This is, and especially if you end up watching it with someone who's not from the UK, who suddenly is sort of like, why are you laughing at this? Why are you watching this? So I think getting older, I sort of drifted away from Bond because I think of some of the stuff we're going to talk about in this podcast, the sort of realization that it wasn't the be-all and end-all of action movies or that sort of thing. And it's been kind of enjoyable going back for this podcast and really sitting down and watching them as someone who now watches a lot of films and just starting to think, right, as a film fan, as an adult film fan, what do I think of each of these films as I watch it? And I have been pleasantly surprised by some, how enjoyable I found them. Others, less so. But it's been interesting as a Bond skeptic to come back and have that sort of rewatch and really focused watch. And see, well, you know, what is good here? What in these films have made it such a success beyond being a kid in England and being told you have to like Bond?
So, Sam, we know you're an expert, and we know, but you're also a fan. So tell us a little bit about your Bond takes.
Right. Now, you know, listen to Alan. Of course, I come from almost the other end of that story. I've been kind of an unashamed Bond enthusiast since the age of 12. And I think it started with my parents forbidding me from watching a Bond movie one night. And I did it, you know, secretly. And it was on Her Majesty's Secret Service. And ever since that point, I've been a Bond fan. And I started to collect, you know, everything about the movies, the soundtracks, all kinds of memorabilia. I published my Bond encyclopedia at the age of 14. And then that was even before I started seeing them at the cinema with Goldeneye, 1995. But since then, I think I've moved into other fields of cinema, of history, of politics. So Bond was kind of like a starter interest for me. And today I wouldn't call myself the, you know, the biggest Bond fan of them all, but I still enjoy watching them a lot. And I think this podcast gives me such a great opportunity to talk to people who have a different perspective on Bond, because I think my problem is, and I'm a little bit afraid of that, that with Bond, I can't be critical anymore because I've seen them just too many times. And certainly they're also my way into, you know, the English language. I wanted to understand all the double entendres. I wanted to understand everything, what they were saying, and also the world of espionage. So I think all this goes back to Bond. So I'm kind of nostalgic about it in a way, but I'm also really interested to get into it a bit more critically and from different perspectives. And I certainly have my favorites, but I also see that there's a lot of like bad aspects about Bond, dated aspects. So I'm happy to discuss that, you know, the best and the worst of Bond with you today.
As for me, I'm one of those Bond skeptics. I live in this space where I can appreciate Bond for nostalgia's sake, or because sometimes they're just very good. But also realizing and appreciating that some of this stuff is objectively terrible. I mean, when I was little, I got to watch them as a treat when mum wasn't home because she would disapprove of Bond and watch it with my dad. But of course, later, as an adult woman, you look at this stuff, you go like, oh, no. You know, so it sort of turns your entire view on these films that you basically grew up with on its head and forces you to reevaluate them with a more modern view on, well, position of women for one, but also how do we treat our characters on the whole and the violence? And is this still good writing or is it just cruel? And all that sort of stuff. So I'm a sort of recovering Bond skeptic, let's say, because if you look at them again, especially the older ones, and especially the more underrated ones, you get to find, apart from all the issues, you get to find a lot of really, really cool stuff in them still, even if they are maybe a little bit dated or more than a little bit dated. And that's why we decided that for today, we're going to get our best and worst of Bond. So the movies that we're going to defend and the movies that we are going to diss on, right? And we all picked a few. So let's start with you, Alan. I want to listen to your favorite because I think it's such an awesome pick. Your favorite Bond movie that you will be in defense of today.
I mean, I picked Moonraker, which is, I know, very much maligned as a Bond film. But it is one I have an incredible soft spot for. And I think I enjoy what it does as it is a very silly film, but I enjoy it for its silliness. And I think one of the things that has always struck me is someone who watched Bond films as a kid, that this is one I really remember being absolutely caught up in. Whereas others I would drift off, especially if he was, you know, romancing a lady and boring stuff like that. This was one that really held my attention. And I think one of the things that rewatching it I really felt, especially, is I got the impression with Roger Moore is a 12-year-old's idea of a sophisticated adult. If you're a boy of 12, he's very understandable about how the adult world works. So seduction is not really anything to do with chemistry or anything to do with conversation or behavior. It is, if you look smart, the women will want to sleep with you. And if you raise one eyebrow, you will get them into bed. And, you know, secret agent work doesn't actually involve any work. You just sort of turn up and do cool, heroic things. And I think Roger Moore works so well on that. And then if you've got this sort of world of the perfect super agent for a 12-year-old, of course you're going to put it into space.
Yes.
Because every 12-year-old loves that as well. And so it's got the perfect sort of villain for a cartoon almost, and the setting is just, the whole thing trundles along perfectly for me, age 12, to watch this and just go, I love all this. This is fun. This is silly fun all the way through. It is, I think, Roger Moore at his strongest in terms of he's not taking it seriously. He is having fun. And I think that fun is quite infectious in Moonraker. And I've never been a fan of the book, so I've never really come at this from the sort of Ian Fleming novels. So I can see why people who do find this such a travesty, find this such a betrayal of the stories of the books. But as a 12-year-old who liked action, who liked space, you know, and who was charmed by Roger Moore, Moonraker is just perfect.
And that gives us a lovely bridge to the books, because one of the more emotional books that Ian Fleming did was filmed in possibly one of the more controversial Bond films. And I think that's your favorite, Sam.
Absolutely. The sixth Bond adventure on Her Majesty's Secret Service, kind of the winter sport Bond, where he almost quits his job, falls in love and gets married. And it's starring George Lazenby for a change. who was an inexperienced Australian model, and he was selected after Connery dropped out, mostly because of his fighting chops. I think he did so admirably well in the fighting scenes that they cast him just for that and because of his looks. And I think despite all the criticism, it's still one of my favorite Bond depictions, even of Lazenby himself. It was for a long time my favorite Bond movie. It isn't anymore, but we'll talk about that later maybe. And because he was different, there's more exposition, there's more character development, there's more actual storytelling. And of course, as a Swiss boy, I loved, you know, the Swiss setting, understandably, and Blofeld's hideout on top of the Swiss mountains. And of course, I think part of the Fleming plot already is kind of bonkers. You know, Blofeld is training these English girls in his Alpine clinic, and the movie makes it even worse because they turn it into angels of death from all different countries, and they become kind of really problematic cliches, racist cliches sometimes, and Bond is then barnstorming this clinic like a rooster in heat, and there's psychedelic hypnosis as well. So part of that is really like dated. But I think once this part is over and done with, it becomes this really great, spectacular series of finales. I mean, there's skiing, there's car chases, there's car racing, there's skiing again, there are explosive helicopter attacks, and then there's, of course, the Bob around the race between Bond and Blofeld. And then at the end, there's this finale, the marriage that actually does happen. And of course, afterwards, Bond's wife is unceremoniously gunned down by Blofeld's henchwoman. So I think it's that, and it's Diana Rigg, of course, mainly, who saves the day for me. She's like feisty and heartwarming, and she turns Bond into a romantic hero for once and stays in the driver's seat for most of the movie. And even though there's like a lot of misses in terms of the plot structure and the dated subplots that I mentioned before, I think both romantically and action-wise, it looks and sounds great. It feels like it's definitely still the same, you know, experience that I had when I defied my parents' prohibition back in 1992.
Yeah, we'll get into that a little bit later, like what we all think of Honor Majesty's Secret Service. Like I said, it's controversial. I think it's gained some ground in later years. People tend to like it more now than they, I think, did back then. So I picked Goldfinger. Of course, it's the big classic. It's the one film where Seltzer and Broccoli knew, okay, we have a hit. This is going to be unkillable. This is the Bond franchise. And Goldfinger, I think, was the big one. It was the big sort of Sean Connery one where they are all unapologetically thuggish and, you know, horrible. We have this again, a cartoon villain, Oric Goldfinger, who reminds me of a certain lame duck president. We have Sean Connery being just an absolute thug in it. But despite all the racism and all the misogyny and all the horrifying stuff, I mean, you can still see it, why this is a great adventure film, why it's nice and gritty, but also has the style and polish of Bond. And I think it has everything. And I think what I like about the olden ones is that Bond still gets to be a bad boy. And I think that excuses a lot of its mistakes, because when he starts to be the pinnacle of sophistication, the rapey scenes get worse. If he's a thug, and if he's just an anti-hero, as I think he was intended to be by Fleming, it makes rather more sense that he's a just completely immoral, immoral person. So I picked that one. So do you want to guys want to go ahead and just discuss our favorites first for a bit? Because they're so interesting.
Absolutely. I mean, just as a short reaction to your favorite Goldfinger, I mean, I totally agree. It's Connery's best installment. And it was a blueprint for so many other successful Bond films afterwards. So every element is in place, the great villain, the henchman. And I think just the gadgets, the cars, and it still really works well. I saw it at the cinema in the spring before they thought the new Bond would come out. And it's still like electrifying. You could see with the audience, it still really works, and it's very, very enjoyable.
Yeah, no, I definitely echo that. I think rewatching Goldfinger, I did have a sort of really enjoyable time with it, and really getting to appreciate Sean Connery, the extent to which he did make this a successful franchise. I mean, there is something in his charisma. I did feel, I think generally, that He's at his finest, I feel, when he's channeling Cary Grant.
Mm.
And I think it's always been interesting because apparently Ian Fleming did say that Cary Grant was his choice to be Bond. And there are moments when you wonder whether Sean Connery was aware of this or whether the producers were pulling him in that direction. So there's very much the notion that he's someone who he looks incredible in a suit, but he's also not taking it too seriously. He also can quite happily fit in another world. He comes from another world. And I think famously Cary Grant, you know, sophisticated tuxedo, but he'd come from poverty in Bristol and variety background. And I think you have this character. He feels more dangerous because he's in a sophisticated world, but on one level, you know, he doesn't belong there. And I think there's something engaging about that. And I think Sean Connery has a good skill for comedy that is underrated when he's bothered. He's very good at reacting to others in scenes that, again, I think builds this idea that you're watching just a charismatic, entertaining character. And that was really interesting because I think, you know, how the Bonds have changed afterwards, it's often interesting to think, well, actually, the reason it was a hit, I think, is hugely down to Connery and just the fact he is charismatic.
And it's interesting because Connery, I think, was a bodybuilder.
Among many other things, yes.
Yeah, among many other things. And Lazenby described himself as just a boy from the bush. And he, of course, came after Connery and then Connery came back in the sort of Bond timeline. So it's interesting that the first Bonds chronologically were both not what we would just, you know, character actors like Daniel Craig is, for instance. These were both guys, I don't know, from not from the streets exactly, but they were not, let's say, you know, character actors in the modern sense. So I think that's interesting because that sort of links the first Bonds together. And then, of course, they go with Roger Moore, who gives it an entirely new, I don't know, twist to be Bond, make Bond comedy, basically a sort of comedy of manners. Very, very strange, really, to come from that and to go to Roger Moore.
Mm-hmm. And talking of Roger Moore, maybe to talk about Alan's pick, Moonraker. You know, I was really happy when you said you would pick Moonraker because among fans, you know, it's kind of maligned and not very well liked, or at least by many. And I think it, in a way, it's just the same as the previous Bond, The Spy Who Loved Me. Like the plot is almost the same. It just takes it a step further and takes it into space, but the basic plot is the same. But there are a lot of enjoyable elements about Moonraker, and when I rewatched it, I especially looked at, you know, Michael Lonsdale as the villain Drax. He's just one of the most sophisticated super villains, and he has this crazy plot to destroy mankind. I mean, it's so obviously over the top that it's enjoyable again. And I still enjoy the locations as well in it, like France and Brazil and Venice. And then, of course, space, like you said, it looks amazing, especially if you're a young audience member. But of course, like, there's a lot of weak elements as well. So I'm not too sure how you felt about the Venice gondola chase or Jaws turning romantic in this outing.
I love that. I think that's the scene that I remember most, is that scene where they run towards each other in slow motion. That's, to me, is an iconic scene in any movie.
Well, yes, but let's say once they throw all things, you know, Marlboro and all the product placement at you, and it's so like all over the top. There, I had some hesitations whether I really like it as a whole, but definitely there's great spectacular elements in it. There's lots of fun in it. I still enjoy much more in The Spy Who Loved Me, or For Your Eyes Only, or Octopussy, that came afterwards. I like the down-to-earth Bonds more, but as a piece of fun, Moonraker is still great entertainment.
I think just when you have stuff like the Venice gondolier and the double-taking pigeon, I think there's an element to which Bond has, it works in two worlds. It has the world where it wants to be a serious spy espionage movie, and it has a world of being very silly. You know what you're going to get. This is a formula. This is going to be fun, and we're going to have absurd gadgets and bizarre moments. And I think what's quite interesting is that I feel that on the fun side, it is stronger, because when you watch the more serious Bonds, or the ones trying to be serious, you can often start thinking of other films in that genre that are better, that maybe don't have the flaws that a Bond has when it comes to an espionage, when it comes to having a plot. And so sometimes when you're trying to be serious, it's almost like, yes, but there are films that cover this ground better. Whereas there is no film I can think of that comes close to Roger Moore in a gondolier car driving through Venice. It is something that only Bond will do. And because of that, I find it's its strongest hand, because it's suddenly doing something cinematic that nothing else does. The only times you see it are people making fun of it or satirizing it or clearly saying, oh, we're mocking Bond by doing this. So in comedy films, they'll do it. But it's Bond that does it, and it does it like no one else. Nobody does this silliness better than Bond.
And that also takes me to, I think, one of the issues that I have with Honor Majesty's Secret Service, which is the tonality where it goes all silly and has George Lazenby in a kilt. Not that I mind looking at George Lazenby in a kilt, because he was a male model and he's obviously gorgeous. And lots of silliness and the joking around. And then the ending seems so very grim. Not because it can't be grim and be Bond at the same time, but because it just doesn't gel for me personally with what's come before. Telly Savalas, who is so awesome as this villain without earlobes. I don't know where they get that, and the silly heraldics. But the tonality of it, and also the way the action scenes are cut, very choppy. It just doesn't seem to gel as a whole for me. And this is one of the things I think Bond gets wrong a lot, is with tone. Are we going to go grim or are we going to go silly? And usually they go for a little bit of both. And I don't think it quite works. I think the same criticism goes for License to Kill, as far as I'm concerned. And I think it's one of the biggest issues with the Bonds that I feel ambivalent about, let's say. Moonraker, what it does is it says we're just silly. We're going there. I don't care if a pigeon double takes or if... And Jaws apparently is a very popular villain, so we have to have more of him. And he's lovely, grinning. So I think it's easier to like because it's so clear in what it wants, as opposed to some of the other Bonds who seem to be written by committee a little bit sometimes.
I think I minded less with Honor Majesty's Secret Service because most of the silly elements are taken from Fleming's novel. It's one of the closest adaptations of any Fleming novel. So knowing the books, this makes sense, you know, that Bond would be in a kilt because he's playing this expert in heraldry, and there have to be those girls because those girls are up there in the novel as well, even though they took it one step further. And I think what I didn't mind about this movie is that it's kind of contained within those few scenes on top of the mountain, and then before and after it goes into a more serious tone. But you're right, as a whole, maybe those two things don't match up really well, and Moonraker is in that sense more of one piece. That's an interesting thought.
I was going to say, my sort of feeling with On Her Majesty's Secret Service is, again, watching, sort of binge-watching Bond films, I did find that I appreciate it so much more when they do bother with a plot, when you suddenly have a hook to get into. And I think On Her Majesty's Secret Service has enough of a story that is engaging, that is interesting in a way that, you know, others don't. And I do wonder whether that's part of the good reputation. I think the ending, what I found most disappointing, is you've introduced Diana Rigg, who is incredible. And at the end, you start thinking, actually, could they have done more with the notion of Bond having a wife and that running into other films? And it's kind of like, we don't know what we're doing with this, guys. Let's just kill her. And her death is sort of having spent a film making you really like this woman. And Diana Rigg is absolutely charming and amazing. And then at the end, just go, and now, just quite arbitrarily executed, that's the end. It's very odd. And I will say, like in terms of George Lazenby and Sean Connery having a similar background, I do think the fact that George Lazenby just does not have that innate charisma is what sinks the film. You just find it very hard to get to sort of like Bond, because suddenly Bond isn't that charming. And I think it works well adding Diana Rigg to the mix. You suddenly think, well, you might have almost an espionage duo going forward, a sort of slight sort of re-riff on the Avengers.
The Avengers, yeah.
And so that would be sort of something that I would, you know, think I'd have time for that. And then, and so it was less the sort of tonality. It was just, oh, this is a shame.
Of course, again, going back to, you know, Fleming's novel, if they had to adapt that the way it is in the end of the novel, it's just the same. She's just killed off and then Bond is devastated and, you know, you have to read the next book to see how it continues. And I think they tried to even come back to it when they brought Sean Connery back with Diamonds Are Forever to have kind of a type of revenge in the beginning and to kind of make it into a continued story, maybe to pick up on that. But of course, that's a different story. And I would argue Connery at that moment was probably not quite as charming anymore as he was, you know, in Goldfinger. But maybe you can talk about that, about lazy Connery as well.
Yeah. Oh, interestingly, what I wrote down is that it is referenced in License to Kill.
Yes.
It's very traumatic because I think the traumatic killing of the Diane Brigg character came from Fleming's life. I think one of his great loves was died in the war. And I think that sort of flowed into his writing a little bit. And then in License, to my surprise, just an aside, they take it quite seriously. They make this entire little scene where Felix Leiter's bride gives him her garter, and Timothy Dalton, of course, is extraordinary, and he's really actually hurt. So if you, again, if you binge watch them, you get these little insights. It was an amazing little scene and really touching, I thought.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that it's not the only one throughout the series. They reference Tracy Bond's death, I think, a couple of times, even in the Roger Moore era, where he's kind of sensitive about it. Those are just like small moments, but they attempted a little bit of continuity or a little bit of a Bond universe, but of course, much less so than in the Daniel Craig era.
And it feels to me, because we also lost, sadly, Diana Rigg quite recently, and I couldn't not think of her while we were watching all these films, because she's so amazing. And it seems, in retrospect, like sort of all these little tributes to Diana Rigg herself rather than to Tracy Bond. I don't know if you felt the same way.
Yeah, absolutely. It would be certainly nice to think that they did that for her.
So, okay, we got our favourites, I think. So let's get to the more dissy aspects. I want to hear the problematic bad boy Bond from you guys. Sam, maybe you'd better start.
Well, I chose an actor we actually haven't really talked about yet, Pierce Brosnan, and his final outing in 2002, Die Another Day. And they were trying to celebrate 40 years of Bond at the time. And I remember being all excited because of all the promises about the true anniversary Bond, with like a million references to both novels and classic films. And then the result, unfortunately, was just a disaster of a Bond movie, in my opinion, trying almost everything and getting almost nothing right. So I think that the problem was, for me, the direction of Leeta Mahori. He's an action director they hired, and it's sloppy, in my opinion, and it's kind of confusing. The editing is confusing, and it's kind of in the style of Triple X rather than Bond. The CGI effects are famously cringeworthy, and I don't think I have to mention Bond riding a giant wave in Iceland, for example. And the action is loud and annoying and intense, and somewhat unspectacular as well. And I think making it worse was that tried to make Brosnan a tragic hero. He's captured and tortured in North Korea, and he strangely disappears, and then he comes back, but then he's Bond again within a second once he's shaved his Robinson Crusoe-style beard. And all the rest of the plot, you know, with the Korean villain undergoing plastic surgery and turning into Toby Stevens, is just ridiculous. And I think it's a disturbingly bad plot. And if you look at other Bond films, it's just a rehash of things like Diamonds Are Forever and all kinds of other Bond stuff, Moonraker. You know, there's references to all of them, but nothing really fits. And what I thought was disappointing was also that there were promising elements in it, like Rosamund Pike's in there as a double-crossing MI6 agent, and she's kind of wasted at the end. Judi Dench is trying to be stern, and she abandons Bond at the beginning, but they don't really pick up on that plot and element. I think worst of all is Halle Berry. You know, she was fresh off her Oscar win for Monster's Ball, and they make her into this CIA operative, and she's kind of an Ursula Andress bikini woman at the beginning, but then she's also a badass action figure. But then at the end, she needs to be rescued by Bond all the time. In a way, she's not independent in the end, and that's so disappointing. And it ends up with this horrible finale with her and Bond and diamonds and belly buttons and double entendres. It's just awful. And did I mention Madonna's in there? She has one of the worst Bond songs, and she's also playing a really bad fencing instructor. So I was really glad that by the end of Another Day, there was the message that Brosnan wouldn't return and they would bring Bond back to basics with Casino Royale and Daniel Craig. How did you feel about that Bond? Or did you want to go into the other bad Bonds first?
Just quickly, what always annoys me with Bond, always, is you get this license as the same, right? It just disturbs the entire movie. Is you give us this character who is clearly a secret agent or very highly skilled or really a superhero type. And what do you do with her, right? This goes back to A View to a Kill as well. What do you do with someone like Jinx? You make her like, I don't know, a flaccid little poor princess puppet. It's terrible.
No, I was just going to say, we've used the term before, like written by committee. And I think this feels like the most written by committee Bond film there's ever been. There's no heart to it. It really does feel like the start of the writing process was just a checklist of stuff that needed to be in this film, who they'd agreed to cameo, what from the past they wanted to reference, what action sequences they think they could do. And it is a film that they've successfully gone through that checklist, but they've done nothing else. And there's nothing there to be entertained with. It is a weirdly empty, formulaic committee movie, which is doubly disappointing because Bond is a very formulaic franchise, but it's a very successful formula. You sort of think, well, you know, these elements do come together. They have repeatedly come together successfully. You'd think it was quite a hard formula to mess up, but it just is. It is this sort of lifeless committee film, which is really disappointing.
And just quickly in defense of, I do like Brosnan as Bond. I mean, it's not that. I think he sort of straddles this sophisticated fighting man thing really rather well. He sort of goes in the Roger Moore vein a little bit more than in the Connery vein. So I do like him, but somehow this one just, it doesn't gel, does it, at all?
Pierce Brosnan, you know, his era started so promisingly with the GoldenEye, and I really loved him in that. He's suave and he's funny, and the movie really works for him. But then increasingly they tried to add more depth to his character and more tragic plot elements that came in. And I think Die Another Day was just the wrong actor to have if they wanted to show him as, you know, suffering and being tortured and then coming back from that. But as you said correctly, Alan, I mean, they don't do anything with that. He doesn't suffer any post-traumatic stress disorder after that in the movie. It's just gone somehow.
I mean, I do wonder whether Pierce Brosnan didn't quite realize that his talent was to play this very sophisticated Roger Moore cartoon hero. And he can do that, and he's very good at that. But I think probably as an actor, he thought, I can do more than this. I can be dark. I can play more levels than that. And I'm not sure he could, but also I don't think he's helped by the script. So I think in Die Another Day, like you said, you've got this notion that you have this element of the story that could play into this idea of a scarred and damaged Bond. But basically, he shaves his beard and he's Roger Moore again. They do nothing with it. And I wonder, you know, whether that's the scriptwriter's limitations or whether it's just Pierce Brosnan couldn't really do that and probably should have stuck with being a 90s Roger Moore. That is the film, I think, where you see this tension, because I know Pierce Brosnan in interviews would talk about wanting to be a darker Bond, would talk about wanting to add depth to it. And you watch the film and you think, yeah, maybe just stick with what you're good at.
Apparently he was really disappointed by not being, you know, called back for Casino Royale, because I think that would have been really enjoyable for him to try that. But of course, it didn't work anymore because of the reboot they did with Daniel Craig.
Yeah, and he also came on the back of, because he was offered the role earlier when he was being Remington Steele and then had to forgo it because he was still under contract and then got it later. And I wonder whether the producers or the writers or whoever the powers that be are still said, well, to us, you're still Remington Steele. I don't care what you want, Mr. Brosnan. He had this image, and I think with Bond, sometimes image is more important than what the actor can actually bring to the table. And Brosnan is wonderfully funny, and he's wonderfully charming, and I think he could have done it. But by that time, I mean, the timing was gone, wasn't it? It was a different time when Brosnan stopped being Bond.
Yeah, and I think what also came as in addition was the chance they had to finally do Casino Royale. because for the longest time they owned all the rights for the Bond novels except for Casino Royale and Thunderball. And once they bought it, they absolutely wanted to make the first Bond. And of course, Brosnan was just didn't fit anymore because they had to kind of restart him into a new era anyway.
Which I think brings you to Alan's least favorite Bond.
I'm not sure whether I would say least favorite overall, especially having watched others, including The Man with the Golden Gun recently.
You're welcome.
I think it's the one that I found most surprisingly underwhelming, because when Skyfall was released, it was incredibly well reviewed. And there was a lot that was spoken about. This is Bond is back. This is the best Bond film was mentioned in many reviews. And I found it, and still do, incredibly underwhelming. And I think it is this idea that they want to be taken seriously as a modern action film. And you sort of think, okay, let's go into that. It's not a great modern action film. And the final third just is tedious. I really struggle with it. And it does a thing which I think many franchises do, which is a curse of longevity, is that they become obsessed with their own past. So rather than necessarily forging something new, they start thinking, well, actually, it's easier for us to start referencing our past. So in Skyfall, suddenly the old car comes back. Suddenly they're making a big thing of, this is Bond. This is, you know, the Bond you love will reference the past. And it kind of gets in the way of thinking, well, the past is its own thing. It's great. Do something new. Don't bog yourself down with this. And I mean, it does start really well. And it has elements that I do enjoy. So I think I would never say it was my least favorite, but it is probably the most underwhelming, both in terms of how it was received, but also because it starts well. Once it goes off the rails, it's all the more disappointing, because you think if they'd kept this up for a whole film, you probably would have had the best Bond film ever made. And in the end, it's something that's incredibly disappointing.
Again, I totally agree with you, Alan, on that, that the Sam Mendes approach to Bond just didn't work for me, neither in Skyfall nor in Spectre afterwards. And I didn't understand why it was so incredibly popular. I just didn't understand why. It seemed like a rehash of things we'd seen before, you know, Bond leaving his job, coming back, and M having somewhat misguided loyalties. And even though I think, you know, Judi Dench is always good as M, but they might have taken it a step or a few steps too far, you know, by involving her in Bond's family history. And then, like you said, this Home Alone style finale, it just seemed odd. And I didn't really, even as a Bond fan, I never really wanted to see Bond's childhood home and the grave of his parents and M dying in this chapel at the end. It was done so over the top. At the end, I remember of Skyfall, I thought, oh, finally, they're through with that, this dramatic arc between Casino Royale and Skyfall. And now he's going to M's office and there's a new M and he's going to get a new assignment. And finally, we can go back to these episodic adventures and they're just self-contained. And can we just go back to that and stop the whole Bond universe, tragic hero, all kinds of characters coming back all the time? And that was really annoying for me in Skyfall. But then I was hoping for the better, but I must say I've been disappointed since.
It also points to the problem with M, and via M, where you get the problem with Bond. Because Judi Dench plays M as a woman, and she calls him, I forget which Bond, but she calls him a Cold War dinosaur. She tempers Bond's appeal as the sophisticated good guy. This is a really great antidote. This makes Bond kind of a bad boy again, kind of a relic, which makes this sort of strange violence and abuse and cruelty easier to place within a certain plot. I mean, we don't mind bad boys. Just tell us that they're bad boys, right? Don't pretend that they're the good guys. And with the killing off of M, you take away this antidote. So I disagreed with that. And I also disagree with within the Bond universe, within this trope of Bond being very ritualized, Bond films being very formulaic, which is one of its strong points. Don't go back to his heraldic history and his family home. You don't do that to Bond. I mean, the idea is that he's 007 and he's a secret agent and he's a spy. And I think he quits every third movie, which is fine. I mean, he quits in License as well. And he quits, I think, with one of the Roger Moore ones. I think it's A Man with a Golden Gun, where he also quits and Moneypenny pretends he's on vacation, all that sort of stuff. We're fine with that. But we don't need the Bond biography, right?
I think what's interesting with M as well is you've got, again, this idea of what do they want to do with Bond and how well are they going to execute it? Because I think they've got a character for Bond that works really well is that he is the anti-establishment figure. So you've got the British Secret Service, you've got M, who is someone who's clearly well-educated, who's clearly got the job through family connections, and then he's going to get annoyed by this anti-establishment rebel who happens to be their best agent. And I think that's a very simple dynamic, but it's a very effective one that works. And I think sometimes they sort of think, well, actually, no, let's turn it on. Actually, Bond himself is maybe the relic. He's now established. He's something that we can maybe critique. And then when they bring Judi Dench in almost for that purpose, they don't go anywhere with it. They don't have the will to say, well, this is an interesting idea. Let's have a boss that actually, to some extent, the establishment is now right. And Bond is now rebelling against something he should probably be listening to. That's quite an interesting idea, but they don't have the will or the interest to really explore that. And if you're not going to explore that, then I think maybe do go back to just have a very posh M, a white older man who's just going to be annoyed at Bond because he's not fully obeying orders and he's too distracted by women and he doesn't... And you know, that works. That is a very simple, fun idea. But again, yeah, you think Ralph Fiennes comes in and you think, oh, that's the way they're going, but they don't even really go... They don't embrace the fun of it, I think.
Absolutely. And I have to say, if I hear you, you know, discuss these elements that could work, and if I think of a Bond film in which they did work, I'm coming back to a Bond that we've mentioned before today, License to Kill. There is, you know, the typical male M that just appears briefly and Bond leaves his job for a good reason. Like, there's a good motivation. He wants to go after this drug baron Sanchez, who has killed Felix Leiter's wife, his buddy at the CIA. And then the whole plot is about this leaving his job and going rogue. And I think they try to bring that back in bits and pieces in the Brosnan and the Craig era, but it never really worked as well as License to Kill. And I have to say, rewatching License to Kill for this podcast, I have to say this has really become one of my favorite Bonds over the years. I didn't like it at first. It was so 1980s and I didn't really care for Dalton and this rogue plot, but it's becoming better and better. And I think these elements are in place there and they work, and it's spectacularly well done.
Yeah, it is. I like License, and I like the, because I just want to quickly mention the cast. You have baby Benicio del Toro, people.
He looks about 10 years old. The moment goodness. He appears, it's incredible.
He's so sleazy.
The cast is wonderful. Timothy Dalton just goes step by step to becoming one of my best Bonds in the canon. He's absolutely stunningly good. He can turn on a dime from being an actual tragic hero in a millisecond to being a complete murderous thug and killing someone by shark in another with a case of money. I think the tonality is off. I really do, with a little photographer girl who's supposedly this wonderful pilot, but again, she's downplayed as always. But on the whole, that movie I grow to like a lot, yeah.
I mean, I was looking forward to rewatching License to Kill because I hadn't seen it for a long time. And I think on this rewatch, what was quite interesting is when it started, I started thinking, oh my God, this is awful. And I will say for the first 10 minutes, it is not a good film. And I do wonder whether this sort of damages a lot of the whole, what they could have built with the Timothy Dalton franchise. It is a first 10 minutes that it's very hard to take seriously. And there is a strange quality to Bond being someone's friend on the way to a wedding. And there's a sequence where he's like flapping his arms in the air as he tries to do a stunt. It's a very odd beginning that I was watching thinking, but where are you going? What are you doing? What's happening? And it's only, I think, when they find the, you know, Felix and he's nearly dead, you have the moment where Bond turns up. And then suddenly the film came to life. And from that moment on, it's got a direction. It really sort of tells this sort of quite interesting story. Bond's actions are engaging, they're intelligent, they're the work of someone who is investigating and after revenge. But the sort of silliness on the way to the wedding, I was surprised how much I just thought, this is just bad. And I do wonder, you know, I know it's his second film, but whether first impressions on a film can matter. That whether that really didn't help the bit of the film that, you know, you need to take seriously. The fact that you'd had, you know, when he's the best man, he has nothing to do and he's slightly gurning in scenes. He has this sort of, he's standing at the side, not really doing much, not being charming, not being, he's sort of like everyone is, the sort of slightly embarrassing. Weddings are awkward. You're always this slightly level of embarrassment as we all get through that. That's not a good look for Bond. And the moment he is this sort of agent after revenge, you see exactly what he can do as James Bond. And the other thing which I found quite interesting rewatching it is that there's often this talk of the parallel between Dalton and Daniel Craig in terms of the dark, grittier elements of Bond. But what surprised me was, I think Daniel Craig, he plays this very dark Bond, but in his own way, it is quite two-dimensional. It is a sort of, almost you could call it like a dour Roger Moore. It's not a character that has much depth, but it has just the way they carry themselves on screen. Roger Moore carries himself as fun and sophisticated, and Daniel Craig carries himself as hard and gritty. And that's what they are in the film. Whereas I felt with License to Kill especially, Timothy Dalton is playing a human being who happens to be an agent who is now after revenge. And that is quite unique in Bond, that you suddenly start seeing the lead as a human being on that level. That he's not this sort of supernatural entity. He's not a sort of two-dimensional figure of fun or a two-dimensional. I was feeling with Daniel Craig, there's an interesting parallel with the world of comics, that in the 80s, comics suddenly got dark and gritty. And they made the mistake of thinking that made them more sophisticated. When in actual fact, it's the same thing as when they're colourful and positive. If they're dark and negative, they're actually not that much more depth. They're just doing the same thing on the same level. Whereas Timothy Dalton really was engaging as an action character in a film, in a story about a person. And that was, I think, the biggest surprise and the biggest pleasant surprise of rewatching it. And again, something that's very sort of underrated about Dalton, that he had this quality. Because even, I think, when he's funny in the film, sometimes the funniness doesn't land. I don't think he's got the best gift for comedy. But you can almost reconcile that to being, yeah, but the guy he is probably isn't that funny. Yeah, this is someone who he's quite a grim character who quips, but actually, yeah, he's a bit of an idiot for doing that. I really enjoyed sort of the rewatching of License to Kill. And even though I can't quite put my finger on exactly why, I found the first 10 minutes terrible.
Well, to your point, that's so interesting, Alan, that you say about the comedy element that might have ruined the movie. When it came out in 89, it was actually almost the opposite, that people were put off by the extreme violence and the seriousness. So the grim characterization of Dalton and these, you know, couple of really brutal scenes for Bond standards. But I was surprised also to, when I rewatched it this time, to see that there are these comic relief moments, even with your Q joining them as a kind of a field agent, Wayne Newton as a kind of televangelist, salesperson for Sanchez. I mean, there is comedy in it, but interestingly enough, people were mostly put off by the violence and the seriousness, the serious tone of the movie. Especially in the US market, it did terribly well in 89. And there was also competition from Indiana Jones and Batman. So I think there were a couple of factors why Dalton wasn't successful and why he didn't come back in the 90s.
I think another thing that really struck me, again, watching all the Bond films back to back, is, like you said, this came out in 89. It's not very well directed, especially if you think that this is 1989. So if this had been released in, say, 1982, I think it would have done really, really well. But I think the 80s is such an important era for the action film genre. So much happens. So much, it becomes much more stylish and stylized. It develops in the use of music and the use of tension in the way you present leading characters. There's so much happens in the 80s. And a lot of that doesn't seem to have been learned by Bond in 89. Especially in the direction, it feels quite a throwback. And one of the thoughts I had watching it is that, you know, it'd be interesting if they'd got someone who was far more in tune with the 80s to direct it. So if you'd got someone like Michael Mann in to direct it, that probably would have been a final piece in the puzzle to really make this a great film. Because I think especially it felt, I mean, watching all the Bond films, they feel dated now. And it's quite interesting that, like, because I remember the late 80s and I remember, you know, the excitement. I remember the excitement of Batman. I remember the excitement of going to see Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. I can vividly remember the context that this film came out in. And it was never going to cut it. Because it feels like the Bond films that were being made 8 or 9 years earlier in terms of direction. It feels like when they do a stunt, it's stick a camera at a stuntman doing something impressive. And it doesn't have to look that realistic. That's fine. That's good enough. And 10 or 20 years ago, it was. I mean, that's what they did. But now presenting, I think, action on screen has become so much more stylized, and maybe sophisticated is the wrong word, but it has changed. And it just hadn't kept up.
No, it's a pity, isn't it? Because as you said, the direction, I also have a problem with the direction in On Her Majesty's Secret Service. Sometimes it's just the director who has a vision that I just don't agree with. And it's the same thing in this case. And also what sort of strikes me watching License now is that we know Timothy Dalton is absolutely funny in his own very dark way. We've seen him in Hot Fuzz, where he is the evil, I think it was Hot Fuzz, where he's the evil guy, in which he's wonderful. We've seen him in Doom Patrol, where he is this very meta, semi-tragic, he can do it. So it's a pity that they never really fully utilized the dark type of humor that he is so very good at. I think it's a, you know, wasted opportunity, I really do.
Maybe one way to explain some of it, because you made an interesting connection between License to Kill and On Her Majesty's Secret Service, they were both directed by former editors of the Bond films. I mean, Peter Hunt edited all the 1960s Bond films before that, and John Glenn was the editor on Her Majesty's Secret Service, and he then directed 5 Bond movies in the 1980s. So I think you can see that those are not classically trained directors that did Bond, but they mostly came from a trade and mostly from editing into Bond. And I think that might explain some of the lack of direction in that sense. But Julie, I realized that you haven't talked about a Bond that you disliked a lot yet. So should we go into one of those?
Talk about lack of direction and, again, a completely misplaced script for a misplaced Bond is my favorite Bond to hate is The Man with the Golden Gun. Because it has, objectively, it has so much. It has Christopher Lee, whom I love. And it was an immense Bond and Fleming fan, too. I mean, he was a bit of a Bond head. We have Roger Moore, whom I also love in his own way. We have a deserted island with, I think, solar cells. We have an assassin. We have... It should have gone right, and it's just a mess. It's just terrible. It has no direction whatsoever. It has no logic. At some point, they end up in a dojo for no reason at all, where Roger Moore is flanked by these beautiful women preparing him for, what? A fight, apparently? Why didn't they just shoot him? I mean, it's just so very strange. So this is a movie that I love to hate because I think it has so many bits in it that taken separately, you would say are absolutely delicious. And then they put it in this stew and it just becomes lost.
Totally agree with that. An imbalanced mess with a few great elements, like you said, like Christopher Lee. And of course, the iconic knick-knack as his henchman. You know, very, yeah, very famous elements, but they're better on paper or maybe better in the promotion than in the actual film. And I think what went wrong with The Man with the Golden Gun is also, again, tone. They hadn't really figured out Roger Moore's Bond yet in the first two, both in Live and Let Die and in The Man with the Golden Gun. He's a bit too serious, and especially he's extremely violent towards women in this one. I mean, look at the scene with Maude Adams and in a hotel room and with Britt Eklund as this, I don't know, she's probably the worst field agent ever to appear in a Bond movie. Like, she's supposed to be an MI6 agent. And I think it's, you know, there's spectacular locations, but I think apart from that, I mean, down to Lulu's awful title song, everything looks cheap and the kung fu fights are all wrong. The car stunt is wasted. It's just a cheap looking and sounding Bond flick.
Yeah, and the rank misogyny that you just mentioned. Again, this is one of those symptoms where I go like, okay, if Bond is a bad guy, I mean, I spent a lot of time defending Shane Black movies for their misogyny because we know that these guys are bad dudes, so they do bad things. But Roger Moore, it doesn't fit him, does it? This sort of very sort of nasty, it's just not his thing. And I think he apologized for the film later on in his life, or apologized, he admitted that some stuff should just not have been in there, like the kid that he throws overboard for no reason. I think he sort of regretted it, and I think, again, they didn't know what to do with Moore, as you say, rightly, Sam. They didn't know what to do with him.
This was the rewatch preparing for this podcast that was the least fun. I mean, this is a dreadful film. It is not, you know, the cardinal sin, it is boring. It is boring on top of being racist, misogynistic. It's boring on top of having great elements that could work, that could have been fantastic. And wasting that is another crime. And what was quite interesting, because I was rewatching films, but I wasn't rewatching in chronological order. So I was, when I was rewatching them, dancing around a little bit across the Bond timeline. But I watched this pretty much next to Diamonds Are Forever. And I think there's a very interesting parallel, because both of these probably fit in the idea of classic Bond, what you expect from a classic Bond film. Or, you know, warts and all, with the sort of flaws of misogyny. But Diamonds Are Forever was entertaining. And it was entertaining in every way that this wasn't. And you could almost see the same ideas, the same concepts being rehashed between the films. But in one, it is fun. In the other, doesn't really go anywhere. You even have the final assassination attempt on Bond in both films. And with Nick Knack, it's incredibly underwhelming. It's just a sort of poorly directed, terrible scene. And another weird parallel, which made you feel like, well, the franchise is maybe going backwards, is in both you've got the Bond girl in a bikini who basically screws up. Because ultimately, women can't manage this. It's Bond that's going to have to sort it out. Mm-hmm. But in Diamonds Are Forever, her screwing up is kind of understandable. Like, Bond slips her a cassette tape, and she misreads that she's got to now put that tape in the machine to thwart the bad guy, not realizing that Bond has taken the tape out. He's already done the switch. He's just getting rid of the evidence. So her screw-up is a very understandable secret agent screw-up that then she's gone and actually put the tape back in the machine that is now what the bad guy wanted. Whereas in The Man with the Golden Gun, the bikini-clad secret agent screw-up is she accidentally presses a button with her arse. You know, you really feel like there's a level of decline, that what is frustrating Bond in one is, okay, you know, the woman is going to screw up, it's Bond, this is what's going to happen. But it follows the plot, it makes sense of the idea that she's an agent. And it's annoying it's screwed up and Bond is going to have to clear up the mess. But they can't even bother writing that. And you just have Britt Eklund bending over and she's so stupid, she actually presses, I don't think she realizes she's done it as well. She accidentally presses a button, the big red button that masks fire up the laser device, with her ass. And that's the best they've got. And even, you know, you almost don't want to sort of defend misogyny generally. But there is a lot better misogyny in Bond than that. It at least presents it in a more entertaining way that is not as offensive. And that, I mean, that was the shocking thing with The Man with the Golden Gun, is just how bad it got across the board.
It's probably the lowest point. I talked about Die Another Day before, but I think that's even a lower point in terms of like Bond history. Britt Eklund's butt pushing that button is just one of the worst moments.
And I think the point with the women in Bond, and I just have to mention this really quickly, because of course it's the big elephant in the room, isn't it? Because it's dreadful and throughout the entire franchise, it's terrible. It hasn't gotten any better either. But I think there's this line between sexism and rank misogyny, where if the filmmakers say, okay, this is a character, I respect the character, and she's silly because we like it that way, because we're all old white guys and we like that sort of thing. Okay, this is maybe could be construed as part of the formula, but just using them either as throwaways or characters to be fridged, or the stupidity MacGuffin, whose stupidity is only there to advance the plot, it's just dreadful and so sad, because I forget the actor's name, but the knick-knack character who also did Fantasy Island, he's really quite good in this. I don't understand why they had to make such a hash of this character being, well, even more of a villain than Scaramanga is, in a way. I think that would have worked much, much better than what they're doing now, right? It's just laziness.
What's interesting about production history is just that, you know, you mentioned Diamonds Are Forever. We talked about Goldfinger before being a very good Bond, and then The Man with the Golden Gun. They were all made by the same director. And Diamonds Are Forever and The Man with the Golden Gun were written by the same guy. They brought in an American author, Tom Mankiewicz, to bring in more comedy and appeal more to an American audience, especially because Lazenby had failed. And so that's kind of their attempt of being more American. They're trying to put in elements like kung fu and the blaxploitation element in Live and Let Die and the casino business in Diamonds Are Forever. So that was from the same people who gave you, you know, great Bonds or better Bonds. But this was probably just their lowest point. And obviously they changed direction after this, thankfully.
I mean, it just in terms of comedy, the basics of getting it right or wrong. In The Man with the Golden Gun, you've got the American couple, and especially the American guy that they meet. And it is painfully unfunny. It is incredible that no one at any point just thought, why are we putting this in this film? And I can't imagine that Americans watching it were that thrilled by this sort of incredibly lazy stereotype.
Well, Sheriff Pepper was super popular. Yeah, now they brought him back for The Man with the Golden Gun even. So it's almost the first version of Jaws, you know, character they had to bring back because he was so incredibly popular.
But I mean, I think in the earlier appearance, it felt a lot shorter, and it felt his character at least fitted the scenario that he was in. Now you have him on holiday, and it, I mean, I reckon if I checked the statistics, it's probably like 45 seconds of screen time or something, but it went on forever. Every time he spoke and comedy stuff happened to him or he was in the car, it just dragged. It was just, you know, it's just doing the basics badly. There's nothing wrong with comedy and Bond, but if you have comedy and Bond, it does have to be funny.
Well, yeah. And that brings me back to, I know he's a southern sheriff, racist stereotype, but he keeps calling people pointy heads and stuff. This is beyond, this is not even trying to be, this is just rank racism, and it's just gross. And there's nothing, I mean, I know I'm looking at this from modern eyes, but I don't think even then that was appropriate at all.
Well, thankfully, you know, they were able to bounce back again and again. So after The Man with the Golden Gun, they went for Spy Who Loved Me, Moonraker, Type Bond, and they were always kind of able, and I think that's the strength of the Bond series altogether. They were always able, after, let's say, a misstep or a box office failure or disappointment, to do something slightly different, to maybe pick up another trend that was going on at the time, be it sci-fi or be it, you know, Jason Bourne-style Bonds later on. And I think that's really the secret of Bond's longevity and success, that they were always able to readjust those elements and make it, you know, make the mix slightly different and be successful again, bring in a new actor in and a new type of story and direction. So I think I don't mind the bad Bonds really that much, because you know they did much better later on and before.
Yeah, and there are, of course, better Roger Moore Bonds. One of the ones that I just want to quickly point out is I really like A View to a Kill, because it has Chris Walken. It has Grace fracking Jones. Oh, my God. She is amazing. And it's terrible, of course, from all the perspectives that we've just discussed. I mean, the Bond girl is fleeing on high heels and Bond calls this women's lib. I mean, honestly, pink high heels. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Bond. So it has all these dreadful components, but somehow Roger Moore has his stride. He has a great time playing off Chris Walken, who does his ultimate psycho shtick. They could have done better with Grace Jones. It's a pity, really, what they do to her, because she is such an iconic presence. And I think this is where I say, okay, I can see its flaws, and I'm happy in the space where I'm like, okay, this is on some level dreadful, but I can still enjoy it, right? Whereas The Man with the Golden Gun is just pathetic.
And again, it's an Avenger saving the day. You know, there's Patrick McNee in it as well. And I think that's one of the best elements of it, that kind of Sherlock Holmes, Watson style interaction, investigation they have. Mm. So definitely agree, together with the San Francisco finale. This is one of my let's say, guilty pleasure Bonds, because it's not supposed to be good, but I still enjoy watching it.
Yeah.
I think as well, I think it was the writer Mark Gatiss said about when they have Roger Moore and Patrick McNee together, and the fact that they're both slightly past it in terms of age. And that this is clearly a very ultimate late middle-aged fantasy that you have these two people. And whether that really speaks to audiences, I always find quite interesting that, you know, you're watching them and you think these would never be in real life two secret agents. They're two middle-aged men playing at being a secret agent. And whether that's a huge part of the appeal. But the impression I thought was quite interesting with View to a Kill is this felt like a film, another film that had been written a bit by committee, but had actually got a lot right. That there obviously was like, who's popular right now? Grace Jones, let's put her in the film. That's part of the committee thing. But that is entertaining. There is something weird in the scenes where Grace Jones is with Roger Moore. It's sort of, it's a clash of icons that they don't quite work together, but there's something quite entertaining in that. And there's lots of elements that feel thrown in, strung together, but it still seems to have enough to be entertaining. It doesn't have that lifeless quality, which is probably, you know, just Roger Moore, his charisma in it, Christopher Walken. There's enough elements in it that it works, even though it does feel a bit, this is Bond by committee.
Yeah, and also I think it's symptomatic of Bond syndrome, is where you have Grace Jones, the strong woman of the time, and the only thing they can think of is to make her physically strong, right? She can't be like totally competent or mentally strong. No, she's just physically extremely strong, because women, we do not know how we're, you know, very, very strange. But still, she's so iconic. I think her image alone gets past that. All right. So we had a lot of Bonds to talk about. We had a lot of problems with Bonds. So does Bond have a future? The Berlin Wall has fallen. There is no longer any Cold War. 9/11 tragically has happened. We're in a different time now. We're in a time of cyber crimes. We're in a time where terrorism looks very different. Do we still have a space in our times for Bond, or is he just past it and should he just retire already?
Well, from a Bond fan perspective, of course, I do certainly hope that he has a future. And I think what's interesting is that despite all these changes and world events happening, they always found a way of approaching a new Bond, starting a new Bond in terms of plot and villains and the thing he was up against. What I'm more interested in is now, because the one thing that postponed Bond now was the COVID crisis. You know, it's been postponed by a year and some production difficulties. It'll be interesting to see if they can release Bond after this. How will the world have changed? Will that be still relevant to have a secret agent go out there and fight adversaries if the adversary is actually a pandemic, so to speak? So will that make or keep Bond relevant? And will they, even in terms of production costs and just the way it can be released in the future, will it even have a cinematic future? Will they go to streaming Bond? Will they do a Bond series like they did with Star Wars, you know, on streaming platforms and so on? A young Bond, a series that they've been planning for a long time or talking about. So from a fan perspective, that's the questions I have.
Moneypenny, the series, right?
They did try to do Jinx. You know, they did try to do a Jinx spin-off after Die Another Day, and thank God they didn't.
No.
I mean, I sort of feel, even as a Bond skeptic, that, I mean, there's obviously the question about how cinema itself will survive. But if cinema does survive, we're very much in the age of the superhero film. And I do think Bond fits into that quite nicely. I think there's an obvious place for Bond in that. I found it quite interesting that the idea of a Bond was written off as the Cold War relic that they even say in the Bond films. But so many of the films don't feel Cold War, because it's not an ideological struggle against the Soviet Union that drives these films. It's a secret agent against a weirdo who has his own mad scheme. You know, it has supervillains long before the superheroes has taken over the cinema. So I think there's a very easy way of the Bond films fitting into how cinema works now. And I think it'd be interesting whether they take advantage of that. I think there will always be a market, however sort of dated it might feel, for the sort of action male hero. And I think as intellectual property in that area, James Bond is the most famous. So I would think he has quite a long future. There will always be stumbles. They will always release a film that everyone goes, what the hell was that? But like you said, they tend to reinvent themselves pretty successfully over and over again. And I know there's quite an interesting issue that this almost certainly is Daniel Craig's final outing coming out. And whether there is a lot already of contingency planning for what happens next, whether there is anything in the film itself that sets up what's going to happen next, I think is quite interesting. So I think, you know, that they're obviously thinking of it. They're thinking of how does this go forward. But just in terms of the genre, it seems in many respects that the superhero world of today really does suit Bond.
I think that this is a time of pandemic, but it's also a post-Me Too era cinematic, you know, world. And I think the big studios and big production companies just haven't caught on yet to what that means. And I think if we want to go back to Bond, and if you want him to survive, he has to go back to being a very bad, bad boy. I mean, in a sense, you have to go back to the original Shane Black type. You give us a bad man, then you redeem him, right? This is what you do in the film now. And if they go back to that, I think they can keep the franchise intact. If they go another route, I think they might just spiral out of control and go to Looneyville, like they did with some of the more fantastic Roger Moore efforts. And I think they have to be careful of that. I think they have to be understanding of that the public will accept an anti-hero and a bad man as a hero and a killer as a hero and a misogynist as a hero, even if you redeem him. If you expect the audience to now take him as he's given, I think they have a problem. I don't know, but the world really has changed to me. And some of the excesses, the rapey scenes in Goldfinger, however good it is on the whole, but that's just dreadful. I mean, all of that stuff, I think they have to understand how to work with that without losing the franchise altogether.
I think there's a good chance of them achieving that. Like I said before, they've managed over time to always adapt Bond to not only trends, but also a changing world. And I think now, especially with keeping Bond in the family, with especially Barbara Broccoli and her stepbrother being at the helm of this, and also staying there. And now with them getting authors like Phoebe Waller-Bridge to write parts of the new Bond, I think, you know, there is an attempt at keeping Bond fresh and fitted to this changing world. So I think they're again trying to adapt him to modern times. And I think that they'll somehow manage. So I agree with Alan as well. There is a need for Bond. There is a place for Bond. And they have the capability of not keeping it the same, but actually working to develop him further.
I also wonder, in terms of just the modern world, whether you can have a lot of the traits of classic Bond, but just sort of embrace it, not as this is something to be redeemed, but he's just a fantastically polyamorous Bond.
Oh, yeah.
And he works in that world and he understands consent. He does understand that, but he also is not going to settle down. He just likes women. And I think there could even be scope for that. I think you could present a womanizing agent in a way that doesn't have some of the sort of traits that now feel dated, that relate, you know, post-Me Too, he can't behave in the same way as he did before. But I think you could, and I think there would be a market for quite a sexually promiscuous young male hero. You would just have to reframe what is going on. You'd have to sort of change the narrative slightly. But I do wonder, yeah, no, a beautiful polyamorous Bond could definitely just be the future.
It could work. Okay, on that note, I thank everyone for listening. Thank you, Sam, for your expertise.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, Alan, for joining us again.
No, thank you. And it was enjoyable, really, to go back and watch a whole lot of Bond. It was really enjoyable, apart from Man with the Golden Gun, which I can say now, I am never going to watch again.
Well, I hope to see you next time on A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.